Welcome to the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. My name is Jason Shoup, and I am the executive director of today's sponsor, the Association of Data and Cyber Governance. The association offers a discount on memberships for our podcast listeners when they go to www.adcg.org and use the code word POD. Today, we are led by our host, Jody Westby. We hope you enjoy the episode and don't forget to leave us a rating or a comment.
This is Jody Westby, and today I'm pleased to have Jeff Jockish as our guest. Jeff is well known in privacy circles, is a data privacy researcher, and is founder of Privacy Plan, which provides data privacy consulting and offers privacy data sets for sale and as a public service. Jeff is a certified information privacy professional and through his work manages to stay up to date on cutting edge privacy issues. Jeff, thanks so much for giving us your time today. I was fascinated in our chat earlier this week when you began telling me about the Data Collaboration Alliance. So let's start with that. I'd really like to ask you to tell us about DCA and what it's all about.
Great. Well, thank you, Jody. I appreciate the invitation today. The mission of the DCA can be found at datacollaboration.org. And it's really to help people and organizations gain control over their information or data assets. We really believe that data has value, but also requires control. However, silos and copies of data really make that impossible. Today, control of our data is really lost, and the mere appearance of control is sort of a myth, right? And here's why. It starts with the way we began handling data way back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, as organizations realized that they could use their data strategically for business insights and advantages. Mm-hmm. Problems really began to arise. The way data was handled was really never fixed. We sort of got into this sort of database models with fields and columns that never really had any access controls. And we sort of ended up in this mess that we're in today, right? And so data gets copied from application to application and new data silos are created every time we want to do something. So the result has been increasing need for continuous data integration efforts, which can take up to 50% of an IT resource or budget, or more than that even, right? So you can imagine the big data nightmare of data copies create, you know? I'm sure, not to mention the impacts on privacy and confidentiality and compliance, right, that, you know, we all know about, right, with the industry and regulatory mandates here and around the globe. So the objectives of DCA is to sort of support new technologies and methodologies that solve these issues and enable universal control and ownership and access. And that also means much better privacy and security as a result. So we're looking for like win-win-win-win solutions across the board. So what DCA really does is run four different programs, sort of infrastructure research projects, and then a data collaboration community, where I do a lot of work. And what the community does is really offer open data sets that are free, right? And free tools that sort of access those data sets. And then something called Node-X, which is essentially software for good that gives sort of software to universities and nonprofits. And then also advocacy for things like standards, like the zero copy integration standard that we talked a little bit about.
That's really interesting. You're right. I worked in the IT industry back then when databases first came out, and you're exactly correct. Now the data just gets copied everywhere and there is no control over it. But this got a great concept is going back to limiting the copying of data. When you were just speaking, you mentioned the zero copy integration standard. What is zero copy integration? And please tell us about the standard.
Sure. So that's a good question, Jody. First, it's sort of important to know that the data is copied pretty much each and every time it's used in systems and applications or even analytics. Jody, have you ever worked in an organization where customer data was only in one table, where that table was never copied, never spun off for a report, for analytics, for marketing, right?
That was the goal back in the early days when relational databases was, then you can have, and the favorite example was, you can have a name and address in one place and not have it in 10 different databases where you have to update it 10 times. But it ended up that we ended up with...
Yeah, right. It never really worked, right?
Right.
Yeah, and it's still not working. And so we end up with all these different copies of the data all over the place. And it's usually not the same exact data, but, you know, we've got customer lists here and there and everywhere. And it's not just customer lists, right? It's all kinds of different tables for all kinds of different data. But that's exactly one good example, right? So we want to make an email blast, and we, instead of, you know, having it in one database, we've got it, you know, copied to something else. And we want to, you know, have data analyzed, so we copy it and give it to an intern, right? A salespeople want to review something, so we export, you know, a tear sheet for this. And, you know, they then go and analyze their top prospects. So every time we want to do something, we end up making copies of data. And it needs to stop. We need to figure out a better way to do things.
I agree.
So data is copied when we're leveraging every type of data solution that exists today. And we're trying to do new things, right, with, you know, with data management and data mesh and data lakes and data lakehouses and data fabrics and all these kinds of things. In a sense, these solutions are trying to get to the answer. They're trying to consolidate data in one place. But generally, the companies that are implementing these solutions are often just adding a new layer, a new copy of data on top of everything else that they're already doing.
Right.
I mean, I've been in a lot of organizations that is exactly what happens, right? So they essentially create this new data lake, but it's just on top of all the old solutions that they already have, and they never actually retire any of those old solutions. So they just have another copy.
Right. The legacy data still stays around.
Right. Yeah.
And stays around even if the legacy app's not used anymore.
Right. So it's not really a solution, right? And so we mentioned before, right, that this integration eats up a massive amount of resources. MuleSoft, another sort of provider, says that system integration costs eat up 30 to 50% of your IT budget. So that's not functionality. That's just connecting data sources, because right, we keep making all these copies.
Right.
So we need to address the problem, but the paradigm is really backwards. So how do we do this, right? So the national standard for zero copy integration has been proposed in Canada. And how does this work? Really, it's the same way that we can control money and identity, the way we're trying to do those kinds of things, right? It's the same principle. It's very simplistic. We have to put access controls on our data. And it's probably, you know, too complicated to go into here what those kind of controls look like. But I guess sort of suffices today, it's very similar to those kinds of things. When you, I can sort of give, we can have some links into the show notes of how people can sort of get more details on that. But people are probably also saying, well, that sounds like pretty complicated. How a business is ever going to, you know, implement that kind of thing? Well, it's also sort of valuable to businesses too, because all of this expense from integration costs, as well as other costs, right? I mean, it's actually very expensive for this to happen, right? It's a very big drag on innovation. It's a roadblock to productive use of data. And it even, you know, has a cost on analytics, because when you've got the data all over the place, you really can't actually analyze what your use of that data is. So,
well, that's true. And not only that, but you may not know which of those data sets is the most accurate one that you should be using.
Right.
And the other thing is, it creates a huge risk for companies, because they don't really know what data they have and where it is and what and who uses it and what it's being used for.
Right,
and
right,
that whole data inventory, data mapping really is very difficult to have current for more than a few moments, because somebody is going to copy some more data for the very reasons you've said, for integration or for analytics.
Yeah. Well, as privacy professionals and data governance professionals, you and I know how critically important those things are and how obviously out of date the information gets immediately, right?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, between the copying of the data and the analytics, and also I want to throw in another A word there, the advertising. Due to advertising, that's also brought in some stuff. But maybe we put in an S word with scraping. This discussion brings all sorts of thoughts into my mind about the HiQ LinkedIn decision that just came out in April from the Ninth Circuit. For our listeners, HiQ had been scraping LinkedIn data for years with LinkedIn's blessing and participation in HiQ events. Then LinkedIn had a change of heart and tried to block HiQ from further scraping. LinkedIn sent a cease and desist letter to HiQ and said that continued scraping would be violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the California Penal Code, Section 502C, and trespass laws. So HiQ, undaunted, then filed an action seeking injunctive relief based on California law and a declaratory judgment that LinkedIn could not invoke any of these laws against them. So the Ninth Circuit just came down with their decision in the HiQ versus LinkedIn case. And so, Jeff, let's talk about that, because what you were just discussing just brought this all to my mind. Can you talk about that case, the scraping decision, we'll call it, and what it means?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of different impacts for that decision. It's an interesting decision. As someone who does a lot of data scraping himself, not PII, but of other data, I was sort of pretty happy about the way this case went, personally, especially that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act won't be used to go after data scrapers. But, you know, if I put my privacy hat on, a lot of the privacy world was pretty unhappy with this decision because it seemed to let people that are going to go out there and scrape personal data from websites like LinkedIn or really any place, you know, including data scrapers like maybe Clearview AI, you know, who's going out there and scraping all of our faces, get away with, you know, some very bad things. And that's maybe not a good result.
Or they're getting data and using it for bad purposes.
Right, right. I mean, so part of it is maybe not necessarily what you're scraping, but what you're going to do with the data once you scrape it.
Right.
And that's pretty much unaddressed by the HiQ decision, right? So there's still, I think, a lot to be litigated on this.
Well, I participated in an ACM panel on the HiQ decision recently. And one of the solutions we discussed was limiting copying, which brings us right back to what you were talking about. I think LinkedIn made a mistake in that, in with two respects with that case. One was not claiming ownership of the data that people post on their site. LinkedIn, early on, probably in the advice of some privacy lawyer, I don't know, said, we don't own the data on our site. That is all owned by the people that post it there, and so we don't have any ownership over it. And then second is they didn't make it a privacy issue with global ramifications and try to look at this with a global solution. Instead, they just looked at U.S. criminal laws, which narrowed it significantly because LinkedIn has 500 million users. That's the whole population of the U.S. plus another half. And so this wasn't just a U.S. problem. But since they said they didn't own the data, then how could they really assert, you know, privacy rights? So it was a real problem. But it really seemed to me that those were the two big issues where LinkedIn maybe could have had a different outcome if they had presented it to the court in a different way instead of presenting it as CFAA.
Yeah, I totally agree with your analysis, Jody. I think that they made the wrong legal arguments if they had wanted to win that case, especially, you know, the way U.S. law is sort of put together, because a lot of U.S. law really has an opt-out for companies if data, if personal data is thought of as public data. Yeah. And so if you don't put some ownership around that data, and if the data is sort of thrown out there as public data, it's sort of loses some of its value as personal data, right?
Well, if they had said they owned it, just like a book. I mean, I can write a book and use a lot of publicly available information, but it's a compilation of all that information into a manuscript and a book that I can put a copyright on. But LinkedIn couldn't say, we've assembled all this data. And yes, you can go find these names in the phone book and other places, but this is our compilation and it's copyrighted. So they couldn't even assert a copyright privilege because they didn't own the data. But we got into discussing, back to your thought, well, what if you could limit where someone gives someone data, then it's only for that one use. It can't be copied and it can't be reused unless the person consents, which that would be pretty hard with the way our applications are written today. But doesn't that kind of start going back to the whole data collaboration alliances thing of a data owner, data ownership and rights to that? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it absolutely does. It goes to the heart of what we're trying to do. Because if you own your data and you can give it to people in a more controlled way, then we probably wouldn't be putting all of our data out, you know, on social media sites in such an uncontrolled manner. And I think that we probably wouldn't have social media profiles, you know, blasting all of our personal data out there in ways like LinkedIn and Facebook and, you know, even Google does. But what exactly does that landscape look like? I'm not entirely sure. I mean, would people start pulling all their profiles out? I think that's still sort of yet to be determined.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, I think we need to address those ownership questions, right? So I think that was maybe the next question we wanted to discuss, right? So what are some of the data ownership issues?
Well, what is this thing that the Data Collaboration Alliance calls its Data Owner Bill of Rights? What is that?
Well, before we get to that, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the data ownership issues.
Yes, please.
Right? Because data ownership is a complicated issue. It seems sort of simple, right? But it's my personal data. It's about me. I own it, right? You can't use it without my consent. If mm-hmm. I consent, I want something of value in return. Mm-hmm. But here's the problem, Jody. I'll break it down into a couple of questions. Question number one, is it possible to own your own data? And number two, if we own it, should we be free to sell it? Now, those sound like pretty simple questions, but they're not, right? So do I own it? First of all, the courts are sort of unclear on whether you can even own data. The insurance companies say, no, you can't even get it covered on property and casualty policies.
Well, they say it's not a property that's being
right,
covered.
Right. Yeah, right. It's not property. In fact, when we think about ownership, we often think it's a sort of a straightforward concept, but ownership itself is often designed, right? It's not sort of an outright thing as to who owns what. When new things pop up in the world, people make claims on them, and then courts have to decide who's right. And personal data is something that's relatively new, and it's also digital, which is very new, right? So think about this. Even personal data can be broken down into sort of smaller segments or buckets. There's personal data that you give to an organization. Then there's the personal data that they buy about you. Then there's data that they observe about you. And then there's data that they infer about you. Mm-hmm. Do you own just the data that you gave to them? Or do you own all the data that's connected to you?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, many companies would argue that the info they collect about you or infer about you is their IP and not necessarily your personal data.
Right. And it may create a digital persona of you that you don't even agree with.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, which is your personal data? Is it all of that or only a part of that? So we don't even necessarily aren't even talk about the same thing. And some privacy laws look at it one way and some are the other way. So, and even courts aren't agreeing on this yet, right? But then the second question is, right, you know, should you be able to sell it? Well, of course you should be able to sell, right? It's your data. Well, but that's assuming a few things, right? It's not always clear. What if me selling my DNA impacts my other family members? Or what if me allowing my location to be tracked means that my daughter, who's with me a lot, is now more at risk? Or what if, you know, selling data individually allows orgs to victimize people that have no other income streams. Mm-hmm. Only the poor sell their privacy rights away and the rich get to keep all their privacy. So there are consequences to these things, right? So data ownership sounds like a great idea and maybe it's very easy to implement, but maybe not quite so easy, right?
Yeah, you're right.
I really expect data ownership rights are coming, even though I'm sort of asking these, you know, hard questions, right? But it's not going to come without some problems.
No, and it's not going to be easy to implement. I mean, it can come as a policy idea. It could even come as legislation. But implementing that, understanding what system integration really involves is a whole different cost and a whole different ballgame. So what is the DCA, the Data Collaboration Alliance? What is it doing?
So we have a Data Ownership Bill of Rights. So it's really a data governance policy that is associated with our collaboration hub. And that's like a free web app that's used by our community. And you can actually find that at the datacollaboration.org/community. So we're hosting a data collaboration community and it runs on Dataware technology provided by Cinchy. That's C-I-N-C-H-Y. And this enables us to leverage a zero copy framework, similar to what we're sort of proposing with the zero copy integration framework. And we can host unlimited collaborations or power free tools, all without generating a single copy of data.
Who belongs to this alliance?
So all kinds of different companies. So there's like many, many. Cinchy is like one of the sponsoring companies, but there's all kinds of different companies that belong to it. So lots of different tech companies, lots of different consulting organizations, all kinds of data organizations.
Do any individuals belong?
Sure. Yeah, all kinds. So really the Privacy Bill of Rights is an evolution of the consent form, right? It bakes the consumer rights from the GDPR in terms of like access control and custodianship and deletion and even the right to be forgotten into the contract, into the platform. And zero copy enables this. And what does this do? It really gives users meaningful agency. It allows users to be collaborators. As users gain more control over the information, that they're actually turning into collaborators with organizations and with developers. And then I should really note that this is a draft document that data stewards in our communities are working on with us to develop. Data stewards like Debbie Reynolds and David Kruger and Kay Royal. And there are a lot more names that you would probably recognize, but don't have time to go through a lot of them. So this Data Bill of Rights really informs data owners of their rights to set granular data access controls that are universally enforced. So that's what our Bill of Rights is about.
Cool. You spoke to me on the phone about a privacy brain.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what that is?
So the privacy brain is really like a set of data sets about privacy laws. I think a lot of people know that I've built a lot of data sets about privacy, privacy laws, privacy podcasts, privacy regulators, privacy news, right? What they don't know is that that data is now available in even greater detail by the DCA. And the data is now set up in sort of an open source Wikipedia style model so that our privacy community can all contribute and benefit from this data. And finally, all the data is linked together in really useful ways with like countries and tags and laws all sort of integrated so that you can, for instance, you could search for privacy news about biometrics and find something and see, for instance, like a podcast about biometrics and see in that podcast that it references COPPA legislation and jump over to that COPPA law. And then you could look at that law and see related legislation for children. And then you could jump over there and see, okay, well, then who enforces the COPPA legislation? And see, oh, well, FTC is one of the enforcers. And then jump over to the FTC record. And then from the FTC record, you could jump over to the FTC website. So all of this stuff is like link to link to link so that you can jump just like you can through like a neural network in a brain. And that's why I sort of call it a privacy brain, because all this data is not only there in very granular detail, but it's all linked to everything else that you can jump around to find just the kind of information that you need.
Well, that's also very cool.
Isn't that cool?
Yes, very. And it would save so much time. And everyone can be so more better informed using a tool like that. We're about out of time, Jeff, but before we close, I wanted to ask you if you can tell us about the new database of private tech organizations you're working on.
Yeah, so I've got a lot of privacy tech organizations out there, but I wanted to know sort of like how many of them are there, you know, and try to sort of start to develop a taxonomy. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of different orgs that have tried to build taxonomies for PrivTech, you know, IAPP and G2 and Crunchbase and, you know, the rise of privacy tech. And so I just started building this data set of privacy tech organizations. And now I've got like 3,300 orgs that I've put into this data set and started to organize in sort of like a new taxonomy. And we're going to roll that out probably in July or August.
Wow.
So it's pretty amazing. Even just that number, right? That there are actually 3,300 orgs that are focused on privacy. That's pretty amazing.
Is that just US or global?
That's global. I mean, it is probably US-centric, but there are a lot of global orgs there as well. I mean, definitely a lot of stuff in Europe and in Israel and, you know, maybe less so outside of sort of the European focus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, we'll be looking out for that. And we thank you for joining us today and bringing these cutting edge thoughts to our listeners. And we look forward to having you again in the future so we can learn about the next part two.
Love talking with you, Jody. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us this week on the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed today's podcast and want more content about the issues we've covered, you can visit www.adcg.org. The Association for Data and Cyber Governance is the leading association connecting all aspects of data management, cybersecurity, and governance. Our listeners can use the code POD at checkout for a discount on all memberships. Thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us next week.